With some trepidation, the Sultan had moved back into his palace. He only half believed Sir John's assurances. But on the other hand, the palace was half a mile from the harbour, where that evil black ship was displaying its formidable broadside of carronades, while the consulate was on the harbour front, or the front line of fire, depending on how one looked at it. On Sir John's advice, Clinton had come ashore with a bodyguard of a dozen picked seamen, who could be trusted to resist the temptations of the old city's red light area, the grog, and the women that seamen dream of. It was dusk when the party plunged into the labyrinth of narrow alleys, where the balconies almost met overhead, led by Sir John, who, despite his game legs, set a good pace, picking his way around heaps of noisome garbage and avoiding the puddles in the uneven paving that looked like a cold minestrone soup and smelled a great deal higher. He chatted affably with Clinton, pointing out the various sites and buildings of interest, relating the island's history, and giving a quick, perceptive character sketch of the Sultan and the more important men in his empire, including those unfortunate new princes who had signed Clinton's black treaty forms. "That's one thing, Sir John. I wouldn't want anything to happen to them," Clinton cut in for the first time. "I hope they won't be victimized for having, well, how can one say, for having seceded from the Sultan's empire." "Forlorn hope," Sir John wagged his head. "Not one of them will be alive by Ramadan. The old goat has a nasty streak." "Couldn't we put a clause in the new treaty to protect them?" "We could, but it would be a waste of paper and ink," Sir John clapped his shoulder. "Your concern is misplaced. The finest collection of ruffians, rogues and assassins south of the equator, or north of it for that matter. One of the side benefits of the whole business, getting rid of that lot. Old Goat will have a lovely time. Compensate him for the loss of face when he straps their heads or hands them the cup of Datura tea. Ghastly death, Datura poisoning. Oh, by the way, you must look at these gates." They had reached the front of the palace. "One of the most magnificent examples of craftsmanship on the island." The massive teak doors were 15 feet high, intricately carved, but in accordance with Moslem law, the carvings depicted neither human nor animal figures. They were the only impressive feature of the drab square building, with its blank walls relieved by the wooden balconies high above street level, shuttered against the night air and the gaze of the curious. The gates swung open at their approach, and the palace guards, armed with the ancient jezails, were the first living beings they had seen since leaving the harbour. The city was still deserted and cowering under the menace of Black Joke's guns. Clinton noticed, since Sir John had mentioned it, that the guards averted their gaze as he passed, one of them actually covering his face with the loose tail of his turban. So the business of the eyes was true. He was not sure whether to feel insulted or amused. "You must see these," Sir John stopped him in the cavernous antechamber, lit with guttering oil lamps suspended in heavy brass chandeliers from a ceiling lost in the gloom. "The heaviest recorded specimens in the world, one of them over 300 pounds weight." They were a pair of African elephant tusks, suspended on the stone wall with retaining bands of copper, two incredible curves of ancient ivory, as thick as a girl's waist, taller than a man could reach, with hardly any taper from hilt to blunt tip, gleaming with the luster of precious porcelain. "You have hunted these beasts?" Clinton shook his head. He had never even seen one of them, but the huge teeth impressed him nonetheless. "Before my foot, I shot them in India and in Africa. No other sport to beat that. Incredible animals." He patted one of the tusks. "The Sultan killed this one when he was a young man, with a jezail. But they aren't any monsters like that around any more, more's the pity. Come along, mustn't keep the old goat waiting." They went on through half a dozen chambers, each of them Aladdin's caves of rare treasures, carved jade, beautifully worked ivory carvings, a palm tree and suspended moon, the symbol of Muhammad, in solid gold, carpets of silk and thread of gold and silver, a collection of 50 priceless Qurans in silver and golden containers set with precious and semi-precious stones. "Look at that china," Sir John stopped again, and pointed out a native cut diamond in the hilt of an Arabian scimitar. The diamond was cushion-shaped and a little out of true, but burning with a weird blue and icy fire, even in the semi-dark. Legend says the sword was Saladin's. I doubt it, but the stone is 155 carats. I weighed it myself. And then, as he took Clinton's arm and stumped off again, old goat is rich as Croesus. He's been milking rupees out of the mainland for 40 years, and his father for 50 years before that. 10 rupees for every slave, 10 for every kilo of ivory. God knows how much for copra and gum copal concessions. Clinton saw instantly why Sir John called him the old goat. The resemblance was startling, from the white pointed beard and square yellow teeth to the mournful Roman nose and elongated ears. He took one look at Clinton, catching his eye for a split part of a second before he looked away hurriedly, blanching visibly, as he waved his two visitors to the piles of velvet and silk cushions. "Keep the old beady eye on him," Sir John counselled aside, "and don't eat anything." He indicated the display of sweetmeats and sugared cakes on the bronze trays. "If they aren't poisoned, they'll probably turn your stomach anyway. It's going to be a long night." The prediction was accurate. The talk went on hour after tedious hour in flowing Arabic hyperbole and flowery diplomacy that concealed the hard bargaining. Clinton understood not a word. He forced himself not to fidget, though his buttocks and legs soon lost all feeling from the unusual position on the cushions. Yet he maintained a stern expression and kept his gaze fixed on the Sultan's wrinkled and whiskered visage. Sir John assured him later that it had helped greatly to shorten the negotiations, yet it seemed a full round of eternity before Sir John and the Sultan were exchanging polite fixed smiles and deep bows of agreement. There was a triumphant gleam in Sir John's eye as he strode out of the palace, and he took Clinton's arm affectionately. "Whatever happens to you, my dear fellow, generations of unborn will have reason to bless your name. We've done it, you and I. The old goat has agreed. The trade will wither and die out within the next few years now." On the walk back through the narrow streets, Sir John was as lively and cheerful as a man returning from a convivial party rather than the bargaining table. His servants were still waiting his coming, and all the lamps in the consulate were burning. Clinton would have liked immediately to go back aboard his ship, but Sir John restrained him with an arm about his shoulder as he called for his Hindu butler to bring champagne. On the silver tray with the green bottle and crystal glasses was a small package in stitched and sealed canvas. While the uniformed butler poured the champagne, Sir John handed Clinton the package. "This came in earlier on a trading dhow. I did not have the opportunity to deliver it to you before we left for the palace." Clinton accepted it warily and read the address. "Captain Clinton Codrington, Officer commanding Her Majesty's ship, Black Joke. Please forward to HM Consul at Zanzibar to await collection." The address was repeated in French, and Clinton felt a quick thrill kindle his blood as he recognized the bold round script in which the package was addressed. It took an effort to restrain him from ripping the package open immediately. However, Sir John was handing him a glass of wine, and Clinton suffered through the toasts, the loyal toast to the Queen, and that ironical one to the Sultan and the new treaty, before he blurted out, "Excuse me, Sir John, I believe this to be a communication of importance." And the consul waved him into his study and closed the door after him to give Clinton privacy. On the leather top of the marquetry desk, Clinton slit the seals and stitching of the package with the silver knife from the consul's desk set. From it fell a thick sheath of closely written notepaper and a woman's earring of paste and silver, the twin to the one that Clinton wore under his shirt against his chest. Black Joke groped her way out through the dark, unbuoyed channel an hour before the first flush of dawn in the eastern sky. Turning southwards, she set all canvas and worked up swiftly to her best speed. She was making 11 knots when she passed the sloop Penguin a little before midnight the following night. Penguin, bearing her urgent dispatches, was hull down on the eastern horizon, and her running lights were obscured by a heavy tropical deluge, the first fanfare of the coming monsoon that passed between the two vessels, hiding them from each other's lookouts. By dawn, the two ships were 50 nautical miles apart, and rapidly widening the gap, while Clinton Codrington paced his quarterdeck impatiently, stopping at every turn to peer impatiently into the south. He was hurrying to answer the most poignant appeal, the most pressing duty of a dutiful man, the call for succour from the woman he loved, a woman in terrible and pressing jeopardy. The flow of the Zambezi had a majesty that Zuga Ballantyne had seen on no other great river, neither the Thames, nor the Rhine, nor the Ganges. The water was the almost iridescent green of molten slag pouring down the side of a steelyard dump, and it formed powerful, slowly turning vortices in the angles of the broad bends, while in the shallows it seemed to roil upon itself as though the leviathan of all the world sported below its dark, mysterious surface. Here the main channel was more than a mile across, though there were other lesser channels and other narrower mouths beyond the waving banks of papyrus and cotton-headed reeds. The small flotilla of boats hardly seemed to move against the current. In the lead was the steam launch Helen, named after Zuga's mother. Fuller Ballantyne had designed the vessel and had it manufactured in Scotland for the disastrous Zambezi expedition, which had penetrated only as far as the Cabora Bassa Gorge. The launch was almost 10 years old now, and for most of that time it had been in the victim of the engineering prowess of the Portuguese trader who had purchased her from Fuller Ballantyne when the expedition was abandoned. The launch's steam engine creaked and thudded, leaked steam from every pipe and joint, and sprayed sparks and thick black smoke from her wood-burning furnace, exerting herself far beyond the dictates of her age and maker's specifications as she towed the three deeply laden barges against the flow of the mighty river. They were making good a mere 15 miles a day, and it was more than 200 up the river from Quelimane to Tet. Zuga had chartered the launch and her barges to carry the expedition upstream to the jump-off point at Tet. He and Robin rowed in the first barge, together with the most valuable and delicate equipment. The medical stores, the navigational equipment, sextants, barometers and chronometers, the ammunition and firearms, and the personal camping gear. In the third and last barge, under the bright and restless eye of Sergeant Chirute, were the few porters that had been recruited at Quelimane. Zuga was assured that the additional 100 porters that he needed could be procured at Tet, but it had seemed prudent to sign on these healthy and vigorous men as they became available. So far there had been no desertions, which was something unusual for the beginning of a long safari, when the proximity of home and hearth could be expected to exert sudden, irresistible attractions on the weaker souls. In the middle barge, on the tow line directly behind Zuga, were the bulkier stores. In the main, these were trade goods: cloth and beads, knives and axes, some cheap muskets and lead bars for ball, bags of black powder and flints. These were essential commodities with which to buy fresh provisions, to bribe local headmen for right to passage, to purchase concessions to hunt and prospect, and generally sustain the expedition's objects. In charge of this middle barge was Zuga's newest and most dubious acquisition, who had been hired as guide, translator and camp manager. His slight admixture of blood showed in his skin, a smooth, dark olive, and his hair, thick and lustrous as a woman's. His teeth were very white, and he flashed them in a perpetually ready smile. Yet even when he smiled, his eyes were cold and black as those of an angry mamba. The governor in Quelimane had assured Zuga that this man was the most famous elephant hunter and traveller in all the Portuguese territories. He had ventured further into the interior than any other living Portuguese, and he spoke a dozen of the local dialects and understood the customs of the local tribes. "You cannot travel without him," the governor assured Zuga. "It would be madness to do so. Even your own father, the famous Dr. Fuller Ballantyne, made use of his services. It was he who showed your sainted father the way to reach Lake Marawi." Zuga had raised an eyebrow. "My father was the first man to reach Lake Marawi?" "The first white man," the governor corrected him delicately, and Zuga smiled as he realized that it was one of the subtle distinctions which Fuller Ballantyne used to protect the value of his discoveries and explorations. Of course, there'd been men living on the shores of the lake for at least 2,000 years, and the Arabs and mulattoes had traded there for 200 years. But they were not white men. That made an enormous difference.